This is the third morning of the Spring Precepts Retreat. Third morning of different wind and different weather. So we sit in silence together. And we talk and we listen. Which one is the real practice? That's what we've been looking at, one way or another. I don't often give advice. When I do, it's usually wrong. But here's my advice for the day. Please don't take anything too seriously. Although we practice as if our hair is on fire, those that have it, it also really doesn't matter. Ultimately, whether we get it or we don't, whether we're a good student or not, whether our mind is full of thinkings or it isn't, one way or another, we are always expressing this great life that flows through us. Sometimes we find ourselves in a little eddy of self-concern, and we worry about it, and we beat ourselves up, and we beat each other up, and we beat the weather and the wind up. But ultimately, even if we don't think so, we are expressing this great life. Us sitting here, you listening, me talking, the horses galloping off, the sheets of corrugated iron on the roof creaking as the clouds come and go. So we've been looking at the koan style of putting up a teacher who doesn't fulfill the expectations of his or her audience. They wait for words and they get silence. They wish for silence, they get words. And how we respond to that situation is typical of our attachment life throughout. And the koans are a teaching tool to just help us to play with that a little. And of course, in the process, to see how anxious we get about it and how we judge ourselves, how we judge the teacher, how we judge the weather, the practice, the Buddha, and ultimately, of course, me. When we are confronted with, again, just to use this kind of koan as an example, when we find, for instance, at a Dharma talk, a teacher who is completely silent and who presents that silence as the teaching, we not only deal with our own reaction to that, but part of that reaction is this the real Dharma or isn't it? How do I find the Dharma? How do I tell it? How do I recognize it when it comes? Because we have a suspicion that it may just come like the thief in the night, and we'll be sleeping while our treasures are ransacked, our televisions are taken off, our passports stolen. Will we recognize it? Will we recognize the other person as the Buddha when they're just imitating? Will we miss the real thing? Or will we take the false thing as, will we take the imitation as the real one? And when we ask that question, of course, this is all the activity of the self. This is the way the attachment mind works, the doubting mind. Sounds like one of those wind-up toys that never stop. The thing that you dread your two-year-old boy is going to get for his birthday. So where were we? Is that the real thing or not? Okay. And the thing is, when we put those questions to ourselves, because we're very efficient at thinking, not only do we have a strong habit of it, but we pride ourselves on being logical and reasonable people. And when we put the question to ourselves, is that the real thing or an imitation? And how will I know for sure? We can't ever say we will know for sure. The logic will not permit that kind of safe conclusion. So we're kind of stuck in this eddy of doubt and anxiety. I'm not sure if I'm speaking for everyone here. Some of you may be wondering what all the problem is. Perhaps I have a strong thinking mind, why I need this. It's why I need this strong medicine. But it doesn't matter if you ignore what I say either. But when we get caught in these eddies of thinking and doubting and cynicism, we can't find a safe haven. We can't find a complete yes. So what do we do then? All we can do really is to make the resolve for our own life to be as authentic and genuine and clear as we can manage. It really doesn't matter if the person in the story is the real Buddha or an imitation, or whether they're presenting the ultimate truth or just their own interpretation, or however we describe that situation. But what I can do is always gird myself with the resolve and commitment to make my own life as enlightened and genuine as I can. And when I make that change, already the anxiety about whether the other person is enlightened or real or authentic, that question begins to subside in importance. So even if I go to a Dharma talk and there's the Buddha sitting up and he doesn't say anything, it really doesn't matter. Whether he is the enlightened one, the world-honored one, or just a copy. What really matters is that I am authentic in that moment. Even if it's being authentic in my doubt. Then when I connect with that teaching of silence, how do I respond? Thank you very much. Thank you for the teaching. And if when I'm there, my discernment is such that it doesn't feel genuine, or that that person's presentation doesn't feel genuine or authentic, how do I respond then? How can I help that situation to become real? How can I relate to that person who's teaching in such a way as to embrace them? How do I save the Buddha? And in that we can do in this embodiment of our practice, in this open field. So all the confusion that we feel about our lives and our practice are the confusions, by definition, of this self that is so concerned. The self-concerned self. The moment that is able to be just released, the open field we find is already there. The walls are down, the gates are open. And there's a kind of an acceptance that just this is it. In that field, whatever speaks to us is vividly apparent. in the world that we find ourselves in, of course, we are strongly conditioned to be judgmental, to have correct opinions, to be logical and practical. In the sense, that's been the strength of the societies of which we are a part. But one of the real Achilles' heels of the life that we all live is the dissatisfaction of endlessly finding opinion and argument and judgment, that shadow side of this thinking habit that has served us in particular ways. And that's endless. A bit like the koan we've been talking about. And there are examples everywhere. I was just thinking of one this morning. In South Africa, debates are endless. Some of you will know. One of them, and this is just an excuse to read you something, popped into my mind, was a debate about whether black people can participate in European music. And as you will know if you read opinion pieces, there's a strong sense that black people shouldn't just take on cultural items of the colonizers and oppressors and should be turning to something more indigenous, whatever that means, and so on and so forth. And then the debate goes on, and of course it never really ends. Everyone is suspicious of everyone else. Everyone tries to make the other look a little silly so that their argument will fail. And for me, that was resolved in an incident which appears as a story in Zen Dust, which is a book I wrote. And it's just an excuse to read it to you, really, because I like the story. And hope you buy the book. I know you've all bought the books one way or another. Now it's time to buy it for your cousins and all your other relatives. But I think the reason the story strikes me, or perhaps I should say, the story came out of just my sort of torment about who's right in this debate, and secondly, just the endlessness of all this discussion and argument. Outside of Kimberley, I pull in at the filling station and roll down the window. A wave of heat floods the inside of the car. Nothing moves. A yellow flag stirs helplessly. I wonder if they've closed for lunch and whether I'll have to serve myself. Then from under a pepper tree near the diesel pump runs a young man with flashing white teeth. I ask him to fill the car and clean the windscreen. We speak about the weather and joke about the rich people's 4x4s travelling down to the sea for the holidays. His skin is beautiful and very black, glinting in the sun like coal. When I say I'm going home, he says he already knows that because he can see it in my eyes. I tell him my home is hundreds of kilometers to the south, past Forestsmith, over the Orange River and into the far Karoo. That dry place, he says. Yes, dry and quiet. And tonight I'm going to sit on the stoop with my wife and a glass of whiskey and watch the sun go down. He looks at me with those great shining eyes. Like church, he says, without the choir. And he laughs at his joke. Then he looks around to make sure he isn't going to get into trouble for talking too long to a customer, even though there's no one else in sight. Tomorrow I'm going to pay Auntie Adams the last money for the dress, he says. It is the down payment on his little sister's outfit for her matriculation dance. Tomorrow morning he will take his bicycle and his week's wages and ride down to the dressmaker to hand over the money. Then he will attend the graduation with the rest of his family, though he still needs black trousers to match his jacket. I open my suitcase in the boot and pull out a pair of black legal trousers. The young man takes them and tells me to wait. Do not move, he orders me. And he runs off behind the building while I stand obediently at the car. The sun drills down relentlessly. Out he comes again in my work trousers and a black jacket, out to the thorn tree with its sparse leaves, where he stands in the shade, legs apart, chest out. And there he begins to sing. He sings an aria that I know, in a height and a voice that is rich and clear. Caro mie ben, credimi almen, senza di te linguisci il cor. Oh, dearly beloved, believe me. Without you, my heart is filled with sorrow. I am stunned, for there we are, the two of us. He under the thorn tree, with his passionate vibrato soaring into the blue. Me sinking down against the petrol pump, overcome with sadness and beauty. Just sit for a moment together.